For decades, Americans have had a love affair with military technology.
No enemy can destroy him. He fights off tanks, hurls missiles one after another. Even a squadron of planes can't stop him. Robot Commando fires his secret weapon. He takes orders from no one except you.
That's a 1961 advertisement for the Robot Commando Army toy, but it goes way beyond toys. It also extends to the GPS systems that you find in your cars today. The computer began as a way to crack secret codes, and the internet was born out of a military research project. But as military technologies became more sophisticated and information technologies become more complex, will we continue to love these high-tech gizmos, or will we want to get away from them? Joining us now, Brad Allenby. He's the Lincoln Professor of Ethics and Engineering at Arizona State University, also chair of the Consortium on Emerging Technology, Military Operations, and National Security. He's going to walk us through some of these new technologies being developed by the armed forces. And also with us, Daniel Sarewitz. He's co-director of the Consortium for Science, Policy, and Outcomes. So, Brad, first let's go through two or three of these new technologies that are coming out. And this is one that really caught my eye. I've been actually reading a lot about it because at first I thought it was a joke, but it's real. Power generating pants.
Yeah. The idea is that you put nanofibers into fabric, and as you move, the nanofibers will convert mechanical energy into electrical energy and run your equipment for you.
Okay, now that makes sense for a soldier in the field. I mean, they wouldn't have to carry batteries, right? But if these came over to consumer technology, would this mean we'd never have to charge our cell phones again?
Well, never is a pretty strong term. It means that you probably wouldn't have to charge them as much. They would last longer. And it may be particularly important if we can feed it into, for example, pacemakers and other devices where right now we're including power as part of the unit, and we sometimes have to take them out and put in new power units.
Might encourage people to walk, too.
Will you get zapped in the rain on this?
No. Okay. No, we would design around that.
Okay, the next thing that that's coming up is brain-operated prosthetics, and it's working for monkeys. How does this work?
Well, what we've done is we've put chips in the brains of monkeys, and those chips have enabled monkeys to use wirelessly arms and other pieces of mechanical equipment that are separated from them. And they treat them as if they were simply part of their body. So you have a monkey in one room and a mechanical arm in another room. And to the monkey, that mechanical arm is part of its body.
You're the ethics guy. Is this a little cruel?
There's different opinions on that. The prevailing opinion is that it's not. What you run into, though, is new ethical questions with all of these technologies. For example, if I get a monkey and I get it used to the fact it's got this mechanical arm, and then I take the mechanical arm away, does that damage the monkey? So you get into some very tricky questions, which are going to become more and more important as this technology is applied to human beings.
Okay, but so that's not nearly as sticky an ethical quagmire as this next one, telepathic helmets. Where people are, you're trying to help soldiers be able to communicate telepathically in places where they have to be quiet, right?
That's correct. And to be able to think more as an integrated unit. So it has very interesting implications for cognitive development. Now, to be clear, the ones we've talked about, the pants and the monkey, those experiments have been done. The telepathic helmet is still pretty early in its development. So I think that's best regarded as a scenario rather than something that's actually going to be available in the near future.
Right. I understand that actually the pants might be available to regular people in like 3 years.
Yes, that's correct. Because, of course, there'll be a big commercial market for that.
Okay. Let's bring in Daniel Sarewitz. He's co-director of the Consortium for Science, Policy, and Outcomes at Arizona State University. And Daniel, it's often a long time before something used for the military or developed for the military gets to the consumer market, right?
Well, I guess it depends what your definition of a long time is. Since some of these technologies can transform society in significant ways, if it takes a decade or two to get from military use to society, that may be pretty fast after all in terms of society's capacity to respond. But generally, if you look at things like nuclear reactors and nuclear energy, or computers, or imaging satellites, you're looking at a decade or two before they go from their first deployment in the military to the beginnings of use throughout society. And then it takes a lot longer for them to really diffuse
right.
to broad use by most people.
Well, you know, Daniel and Brad, I was reading this great essay by Steven Weinberg, the late Nobel Prize-winning physicist, about military technology, and he was describing how the track record in the military for developing technology for actual warfare is pretty bad. Generals fall in love with things that end up being kind of useless on the battlefield, but the trickle-down in the civilian world, on the other hand, they have a really terrific track record. Daniel?
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. So, for example, long-range strategic bombing in World War II didn't really do much but kill civilians and reinforce the resistance of countries to their attackers. But, of course, the development of those sorts of technologies was crucial for the development of the airline industry. So the fact is that the military will try to do anything to get an advantage, and a lot of what it does doesn't work, and as you say, becomes sort of the object of a faddish obsession on the part of the military. But a lot of stuff does and turn out to be incredibly helpful. So it's easy to find exceptions. I think the point is that the military is always looking for a technological advantage against its enemies, and as a result, it's an incredible sort of a petri dish for technological innovation. That society then finds different uses for.
Okay, Brad Allenby of the Ethics and Engineering Department at Arizona State University. I mean, I would imagine when you start talking about telepathic helmets that would make soldiers behave more as a unit, that makes people kind of nervous.
Well, I think it has implications that could make people nervous. But if you think about its actual application in the military, anything that enables me to have a better chance of coming out alive is going to be pretty attractive.
But is there a moral problem with having so much innovation in the war domain in America? Shouldn't it be somewhere else?
Well, that's a very complicated question. And it goes to the heart of what this technology raises, which is, what does it mean to be human? Humans tend to innovate very rapidly in an environment of conflict. As Dan's pointed out, part of that is because the stakes are so high. And because of that, you tend to get technologies coming out of military operations that this has been true throughout history. It was true early in the Middle Ages with fortifications, with gunpowder. The changes that they introduced into society were huge. It's a condition that I think we have to live with, and I think we need to get much better at understanding it because we are getting a lot more innovation out of the military.
And maybe accepting it as well. Brad Allenby, Lincoln Professor of Ethics and Engineering at Arizona State University, and Daniel Sarewitz, co-director of the Consortium for Science, Policy, and Outcomes at Arizona State
that
University.
That was fascinating. Where do you come down on this, ethically, morally, or otherwise, military technology? Call us at 877-8MY-TAKE or post a comment at thetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headley. This is The Takeaway.